II, Nazis, A Daring Mission, Ian Fleming, and Henry Cavill. How could you go wrong? You don't. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 5, Episode 16 of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. This is where we talk about writing, spies, and writing about spies. I'm your host, espionage author P.A. Duncan. So this past weekend, I went to see the new movie, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, directed by Guy Ritchie. Ritchie is one of my favorite directors of action movies, though he is an acquired taste. My first viewing of his 2015 reboot of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was meh, but after my second or third watch, I was a fan. Indeed, I'd love to see him direct a Star Trek movie. Some Trekkies are now clutching their pearls hearing that, but I think it would be awesome. The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is, so it claims, based on a real operation discovered among Winston Churchill's personal papers declassified in 2016. Except that an author named Damian Lewis wrote a nonfiction book in 2014 entitled Churchill's Secret Warriors, The Explosive True Story of the Special Forces Desperados of World War II. Information on the movie indicates that it is based on that book. The alleged operation depicted in the movie is described as the origin of special forces warfare and/or the origin of Churchill's special operations executive, famous in World War II for its sabotage and espionage operations in Europe and its use of women operatives. In the movie, several real people pop up as central to the plot. Ian Fleming as a naval intelligence officer who helps to plan the mission. A Brigadier Gubbins, whom everyone refers to as M. A British Army Major Gus March Phillips. A Danish commando, Anders Lassen, Churchill, the actress Marjorie Stewart, and several others who were only discovered once the SOE files were declassified in the early 21st century. Ian Fleming, by the way, also shows up in another great wartime movie based on a real event, Operation Mincemeat. Take a look at that one, too. I think I've talked about it before. Great movie. Think of this new movie as Guy Ritchie's homage to the old TV series, The A-Team. I got that vibe while watching it. But that was, interestingly enough, one of my favorite shows, as stupid as it was, so I understand. The operation focused on in this movie takes place in the early 1940s, when Churchill's military staff were encouraging him to take a truce offered by Hitler. This is true. Until the U.S. got troops to England, England was standing pretty much alone against Nazi Germany and not faring well at it. The Germans kept encouraging surrender or truce, but Churchill was adamant against accepting it. The aid promised by the United States was being sunk on ships in the North Atlantic by Germany's wolf packs of U-boats, and that's the focus of this movie. The U-boats, according to the film, are being rearmed and resupplied by a ship anchored at an island off the coast of West Africa. Churchill believes, at Fleming and M's encouragement, that if that supply chain can be broken, the U-boat attacks will lessen, and much-needed food and ammunition and U.S. troops will come through for the British. However, Churchill also recognizes that conventional warfare probably won't achieve this mission. So this young Ian Fleming supplies him with the names of some military misfits who can get the job done, though they use dubious methodology. When his heads of the armed forces insist that such an operation wouldn't be appropriate, was ungentlemanly, movie Churchill responds, "If Hitler isn't playing by the rules, then neither shall we." Great line. I don't know whether Churchill actually said it, but it certainly sounds like him. My personal belief is that being gentlemanly was the problem. Neville Chamberlain, Churchill's predecessor, was of the gentleman class in Britain, and he simply expected other politicians, other heads of state, like Hitler, to act as a gentleman as well. Churchill, however, saw Hitler for what he was, which was not a gentleman in any sense of the word, and he was determined not to give in to Hitler. So, Churchill approves this non-official mission to take out the supply ship off the African coast without the approval of the Lord Admiral or other military heads of his armed forces. The action in this movie is violent. But then, Nazis, okay? The violence is also over the top, bordering on fantastical. But that's Guy Ritchie, and this is also fiction. How this, dare I say, ragtag team works so fluidly together may not necessarily be fiction, and their ability to improvise when receiving new intel is a good depiction of tradecraft. I thought it was a good, entertaining movie, but you have to suspend reality for a couple of hours to enjoy it. Good performances, some snarky humor, and of course, the Nazis get their comeuppance. That's always a plus for me. Wait for the Where Are They Now segment at the end before the credits to see who was real and what their ongoing contributions to Churchill's ungentlemanly warfare were. Again, an enjoyable film if you put history aside for a while. And I do think I'd like to read Damian Lewis's book I referenced earlier. I suspect it's the kind of book I'd nerd out on. Besides, my birthday's coming up, and who says I can't give myself a present? And now it's commercial time. Speaking of presents, once again, it's my birthday month, but this week, I'm giving you free books. All three books in the Spy Flash series, Spy Flash, Spy Flash 2, and Spy Flash 3, have been free since yesterday and will be free through Saturday. The Spy Flash series will take you from some of my earliest My Alexei stories in Spy Flash to the types of things that inspire me to write. In Spy Flash 2, headline events that happened in the summer of 2016, and in Spy Flash 3, a list of informal protocols for CIA case officers in the Cold War, and maybe even today, the Moscow rules. So, if you want a present from me on my birthday, go click the link to the Spy Flash series, which I'll put in the description for this episode. Starting May 1st, look for the pre-order for my ebook box set Secrets to Begin, and I'll also be celebrating a book birthday all month. It's the 7th book birthday for my debut novel, A War of Deception. So stay tuned for a reduced ebook price and some free days. And commercial over! I'm going to read a bit from the beginning of the first book in Secrets. Book one is titled A Spy's Legacy, but let me set this up. Nelson, and this is pre-Alexei, meets secretly in a private dining room in a DC Chinatown restaurant with Sir John Stone, the Directorate's London station chief, and friend of two Directorate operatives, Frederick Fisher and Catherine Maitland Fisher, who are, yes, my Fisher's parents. This is 1963, and Mai, called Matty by her parents, is only 5 years old. Frederick and Catherine have been reported killed in Taiwan, but John Stone isn't buying the evidence given him. Secrets, A Spy's Legacy, Chapter 2, Uncertainty. The odors from the kitchen were tantalizing. The waitresses gave the orders to the cook in Mandarin. The patrons were a few local residents, white men and women, attired in suits and dresses. Others were tourists in casual dress, all also white. The hostess bowed to Nelson and said, "A pleasure to see you, Mr. Nelson. Please, follow me." She led him through the restaurant, down a corridor, past the restrooms, and to a narrow stairway. She went first, allowing him to appreciate the sway of her hips in the form-fitting dress. John Stone was alone in the upper dining room, but that wasn't unusual. This room wasn't for the public, but for special guests of the owner, who happened to be the hostess and a longtime asset for several intelligence organizations. Stone puffed on his pipe and rose when Nelson entered. They shook hands. In the center of the table was a bottle of what had to be Baijiu, a potent white liquor made from sorghum. Stone already had a glass in front of him, and the hostess, Song Ju, poured some for Nelson. She pointed to a buffet laden with various dishes Nelson knew wouldn't be served to the downstairs clientele. He and Stone warranted authentic Taiwanese cuisine. The buffet was so the two men could converse without interruption from servers. The hostess bowed to both men and left the room, closing the double doors behind her.
"Let's plate up while it's warm, eh?" said Stone, rising and heading for the buffet.
The two men returned to the table with bowls of beef noodle soup and plates laden with rice and a variety of dishes. They started with the soup but used chopsticks to eat the soup's noodles and to sample the food from their plates. They dined in silence for a while, and Nelson remembered why he liked this place as much as Stone did. Every bite he took exploded with flavor, far more satisfying than the bland offerings downstairs, intended for tourists. Stone dabbed at his mouth with a napkin and passed an eyes-only envelope to Nelson, who noted the seal had been broken. Nelson took out a report he considered too sparse for an investigation into the deaths of two longtime operatives. He continued to eat as he looked over the contents. Stilted bureaucratic language, euphemisms for torture.
"Did the embassy get the bodies?" Nelson asked.
"No, incinerated after execution."
"How long were they in custody?"
"The station chief isn't certain. They were headquarters operatives and generally operated independently of the Taipei station. The chief had no idea they were missing until the embassy was notified of their deaths."
Ah, the airline tickets. June 27th.
"Nearly 3 months ago."
"Yes,"
Stone said in a low voice. "A week past the 18th wedding anniversary."
When Nelson got to the pictures, he studied them closely. He pushed his plate away. His appetite had fled.
The naked bodies of a man and a woman, their severed heads placed on their stomachs. Nelson would know Freddie Fisher anywhere. The aristocratic looks, the Clark Gable mustache, though now obscured by a months-old beard. A thick mop of hair he usually wore slicked back with some typically British styling concoction. Now his eyes were bulging, his tongue protruding.
but almost no blood came from the severed head. He had to have been beheaded post-mortem. Catherine's red hair had been moved back off her face to show her identity. Her mouth drooped open. The eyes were half closed, but Nelson saw they were the right color of dark blue. "The beauty mark on her upper lip," Nelson said. "Yes, that's what I noticed." "There is a great deal of bruising on her face. That could be hiding it. It's not a good quality picture. Blowing it up wouldn't help with clarity." Nelson set the picture aside, face down. "I have no doubt that's..." Stone began, then stopped. "That's Freddy. I'm not certain at all. That's Kate." "I don't know, Johnny. You're putting a lot into a missing blemish. Again, the bruising on her face. What did Sungju say?" "Her sources say it happened. But I don't believe that is Catherine." "And if you decide to challenge that?" Nelson asked. "The goal would be to find her then." He thumped the table with a fist. "And bring her home. I'll wager a double was involved. Someone in Taiwanese intelligence who's a double for the commies took her. The Taiwanese didn't want the embarrassment and staged her death." "If that's the case, if it's the Chinese communists, they've had time to turn her and..." "Never! She would never!" "Johnny, your heart's too much into this. You're seeing what you want to see because you and I both know you've always loved your best friend's wife." Stone blinked, his eyes hardening, and Nelson saw murder in them. That passed as quickly as it had occurred, and Stone stared at an indefinite point across the room. "Johnny, your responsibility now is Freddie and Kate's little girl," Nelson said with uncharacteristic concern. "They'd want you to make sure she has the best possible life, the one they would have given her. They wouldn't want you to chase their ghosts." Stone's chin crimped, trembled, but a steadying breath later, his face relaxed. "For a traitorous colonist, you're right, Lord N," Stone said. Nelson smiled at the nickname. Nelson's father had named him Horatio, the reason why Nelson never used his first name. Stone had always called him Lord N. Stone gathered the report and the photos and slid them into the envelope. That he tucked away in his briefcase. He turned to Nelson, his expression jaunty. His eyes, however, were haunted. "I'm ready for seconds," Stone said, and returned to the buffet. Of course, Nelson doesn't leave it there. Stone's suspicions are enough to encourage Nelson to look into the possibility Catherine Maitland Fisher is still alive. And, well, spoilers! You'll have to read the book to find out what happens. Yeah, I'm sneaky. Comes from writing about spies. Spring is truly here, given my watery eyes and constant sneezing. I've edited them out of this podcast, but they were there. So you can't prove spring by me, since we've had several nights in a row this week with freeze warnings here in the Shenandoah Valley. However, in the daytime, I'll pop a Claritin to make sure my sneezing doesn't give me away as I keep an eye out for spies. The proceeding has been a production of Unexpected Paths Media, copyright 2024. All rights reserved. Join us next week for a new episode of the Real Spies, Real Lives podcast. I am grateful the U.S. Congress came to its senses and approved military aid for Ukraine this week. Slava Ukraini!